Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's 7 o'clock on a Saturday night, which means it's time for The Other Podcast. I'm your host, Robert Stacy McCain.
And I'm not. Hi, folks. It's the other guy on The Other Podcast. Hi, I'm John Hogue. By the way, folks, I don't know if I mentioned this before, but Stacy blogs at a blog called TheOtherMcCain.com and also writes at other fine spots around the interwebs.
Yes, and you can find my good friend John Hogue's work at Hoguewash.com.
At least that's the latest rumor.
And, of course, it being a Saturday night in November.
Oh, we must have just had Thanksgiving. How'd your Thanksgiving?
My Thanksgiving was awesome. I had five of my six children, plus three of my five grandchildren, and let's see, my brother. And but anyways, we had 14 for Thanksgiving, and I don't know whether that's within state policy or not, but
Well, come get me, copper. Well, yeah. And first of all, they've got to figure out which undisclosed location that you're actually in.
Right.
I had just my son and me for Thanksgiving this year. He did a venison roast for us. I normally do a turkey on the grill, but there just weren't enough folks to go around. So we made a spot in the freezer for some more venison. It's opening day today. So something may or may not be happening. I usually use a 270 Winchester for deer hunting, but just on the way over here, a guy was using a Chrysler 300.
The deer in this neck of the woods are quite plentiful. As a matter of fact, you can't really, drive anywhere without having to watch for deer.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, Thanksgiving was the bright spot of the week. I'm going to tell people about what happened leaving here on last Saturday evening. I tripped on the edge of your driveway, sprained my ankle, and I spent most of the week with pain meds.
Allegedly. I want to say allegedly he tripped in my driveway, because I'm not going to.
I didn't say in your driveway. I said on the edge of your driveway.
I'm going to avoid liability here for my faulty driveway. But anyways,
But you know what, Stacy? Let's not worry about that. Let's worry about football.
That's right. It's a Saturday night in November.
And it's Thanksgiving weekend. Those are the really big games.
Yes, that's right. And speaking of really big,
I get to go first. My team maintained their perfect record. Missouri beat Vanderbilt 51-0.
Yes, and Vanderbilt actually had a girl playing for them. It's really sad, but anyways, but meanwhile, in real football, the University of Alabama, number one in the country, defeated hated arch rival Auburn 42-13 with Mac Jones. Mac Jones threw for 302 yards, including five touchdowns. Two of those touchdowns were to Devontae Smith, who last week broke the all-time SEC record for touchdown catches. So he is now the greatest receiver in SEC football history.
Which is a reasonable accomplishment for a young man.
Yeah, well, it's Alabama. You know, by the way, they played the game without their head coach because Nick Saban came down with the coronavirus. He's expected to recover, but had to sit out the game because you know, these weenies, or they're afraid of some germs. Meanwhile, in other games, number three ranked Clemson is leading Pittsburgh 52-17 in the fourth quarter. Clemson, by the way, a friend of mine went to Clemson.
Actually reasonable people have gone to Clemson from time to time. I even know some nice folks who made the mistake of going to Auburn.
Yeah, well, that's I try not to do. You know, but this is one of the things. Well, look, they think they're at a real university.
Well, I mean, you know, it's their hometown.
And I don't want to. It's
their hometown school. What are they going to do?
Yeah, anyways.
Like, well, I went to Vanderbilt.
Meanwhile, back at the ranch, number eight Northwestern is currently trailing Michigan State in Lansing, 23-20. There's about 2 minutes left there, and Michigan State has the ball, so it's going to be tough for Northwestern to come back on that one. But we shall wait and see.
Well, the only dog I have in that fight, I guess, is I have a sister-in-law who got her law degree from Northwestern, but that's about it.
Indiana. We'll be talking about someone from Indiana later. But
my wife went to Indiana.
Yeah. Well, anyways, but Indiana 27, Maryland 11. Coastal Carolina, ranked 20th and undefeated, beat Texas State 49-14. Oklahoma State held on, ranked number 23rd. Oklahoma State defeated Texas Tech 50-44. And later on this evening, let's see, who will be playing tonight? There are some late games tonight. I'm trying to recall who those are. But anyways, but yes, I think LSU plays somebody. Mississippi State? No, Mississippi State played Ole Miss today. Okay, well, anyways, there's going to be some late games tonight, but I think I caught you up.
Is LSU playing Tulane today?
What?
Would they be playing Tulane today? Cross-state?
I'm looking.
Cross-state rivalry?
I'm looking at the schedule. The schedule was right in front. At 7, just now about to kick off, LSU was playing at number 5. Texas A&M is their only loss was the University of Alabama, and everybody loses to Alabama. At 7:30, Georgia, ranked number 9, plays at South Carolina. This week in number 4, Ohio State, their game against Illinois got canceled because of the coronavirus.
Well, Vanderbilt was supposed to play UT today instead of Missouri. The Missouri game had been canceled earlier, so I guess there must be something going on virus related there.
Yeah, well, next week Vanderbilt got that L virus.
Next week Vanderbilt plays Georgia, and the way 2020 has been going, that's got to be the only way Vanderbilt could blow its perfect record for losses.
All right, then. Okay, so you're now caught up on football, and before we turn to the headline stuff, we're going to start with an old acquaintance of ours.
Well, actually, it somehow relates to the headlines. This has to do with elections and Democrats.
Yes.
I guess the way I came to meet.
Let's tell you about Brett Camberlin. Who is Brett Camberlin?
Well, you know, when people ask me to explain that, I usually start off by saying, do you remember the guy who was a federal prisoner who claimed he was Dan Quayle's dope dealer? And people of a certain age at least remember that, and they remember it on NPR, and they remember it then in
the Doonesbury cartoons. Yes. He was a convicted bomber. He is convicted bomber.
First he was a convicted perjurer because it was easier to get him for that than for dealing LSD. And then he was a confessed drug smuggler.
Yes.
And then almost simultaneously got involved in being a serial bomber and got convicted of that. His
also impersonating a federal officer
and misuse of the presidential seal.
Very strange criminal mind, Brett Kimberlin.
Yes. Anyway, the way I came to meet Stacy, folks, was the fact that Stacy and I both were writing about Kimberlin because of some shenanigans he was pulling against a lawyer by the name of Aaron Walker that got a whole bunch of First Amendment related people interested in what was going on. And Stacy had to move his family for safety because of threats. And then we became working together on the same story. And that's 2012, Stacy. We've been at this for 8.5 years
yes,
now.
It's 2012. You know, and what resulted, I remember being in court. We were down when Aaron had a hearing.
Yeah, the first time we physically met was in December of 2012.
In a Virginia case.
But anyway, we got sued. Yes, we got sued because we were writing truthful things about him, and that was considered defamatory. And basically, Kimberlin has filed lots of lawsuits. He sued Stacy twice. He sued me 4 times. He sued Lee Stranahan 4 or 5 times.
Yeah, Michelle Malkin, Breitbart. He sued everyone.
Simon & Schuster, James O'Keefe. I mean, you know.
It's a pretty stellar.
U.S. Chamber of Commerce, Pacific Northwest National Laboratories, which is a federal lab.
He also once sued a porn company because the porn magazines he was getting in prison weren't sufficiently arousing.
Yes, but that was back in when he was in prison back in the
80s. Well, now he's a nonprofit progressive activist.
Yes, and one of the things he set up with a guy by the name of Brad Friedman was a thing called Velvet Revolution, the name of which got changed to Protect Our Elections /EMPR. EMPR stands for Euromaidan Public Relations, which is a Ukrainian news site that's run in English. How that connects to protecting our elections, I'm not sure. But back in 2012, actually, I had a post about the Kimberlin, one of my Team Kimberlin posts of the day, and it had to do with his Velvet Revolution organization, quote, being bigger than it seems. You see, I found a thing from an annual report from 2008 from the Threshold Foundation, which is one of those nebulous sorts of grant-making things that funnels money from people like Soros around the world. In that year, they gave Velvet Revolution $35,000 for what was referred to as a, quote, election protection strike force. And they identified the organization as having 154 affiliate organizations and 18,984 members. Now, if Velvet Revolution ever had more members that would require Kimberlin to take off his shoes to begin counting the membership, I would be absolutely shocked. It's just absolute lying to refer to the organization that way. But, you know,
he may have had an email list.
Well, or he may have been affiliated with 154 organizations because he circled numbers on a bingo card in a magazine for that many, or sent emails to them. Whatever. The whole thing is, this is the way that activist organizations have been funded through the years by the Democrats. And there's been less of that this year, though. This year, a lot of the work has been internal inside of more tightly held organizations. And that had to do with really the logistics, not of protecting the elections, but having a fraudulent election. But the problem that happened was the Democrats believed their own polling. And what happened on election night was they had set the algorithm up for the vote splitting, and it wasn't enough. They had too many Trump votes coming in anyway. So with that happening, they had all sorts of problems that caused logistical glitches, and that has caused them to be caught. As a result, we've got a bunch of really interesting lawsuits going on.
I'm looking at your headline. I'm looking at your lead paragraph. That's pretty cute.
I'm flipping the order. I'm going to dispose of another civil rights lawsuit first. And that was the one that I'll just mention in passing about Cuomo having his ass handed to him by the Supremes about locking down churches and synagogues.
Yeah.
But the other case that I started talking about was C.J. Pearson versus Kemp. And that is going on in U.S. District Court. Hi, Marley. Now be quiet.
Yeah, that wasn't Marley. That was Ginger.
Oh, that was Ginger? Okay. Anyway, the other case I've been talking about, C.J. Pearson versus Kemp, which is a Georgia case. C.J. Pearson is a young black man in Georgia. You know, he's probably not the first black man to file a civil rights lawsuit related to voting in Georgia.
Yeah.
But that's been going forward with Lynn Wood as one of the local council and Sidney Powell running that one. But yes, you're probably talking about the opening line of the later in the week summary about the lawsuits. Sidney Powell finally released a couple of mid-sized kraken, one in Georgia and one in Michigan.
Do I hear some laughter in the background?
Yes, you do, because guess who has joined us?
From Georgia.
I'll bet you. Yes. How are you doing?
I'm great. I'm really happy to be here. I'm sorry I was late, but
life happens.
Country back roads are country back roads.
Folks,
and this, they're beautiful this time.
In case this is your first time listening to the other podcast, this is our regular guest, I guess you would say, the lovely Diana.
You know, I've been meaning to bring this up, but we probably ought to just make her part of the team. You know, she adds a lot to this show.
She does, especially the laughter.
What do you think about it, that offer, Diana?
I think that sounds amazing.
Okay. So
I would accept with pleasure.
Okay, you're hired.
Great.
Anyway, but so, okay. We'll talk about your pay later.
Well, we're not going to charge her that much.
Oh, okay. Right.
We talked about what was going down in Georgia. Have you got any local news to add about the Pearson v. Kemp lawsuit?
I haven't had a chance to talk about this to a few people who I know will be interested. I'll probably have a chance this coming week. I will say that I have been speaking to a lot of people who are just walking around going, how did this happen? How is any of this possible? Now, remember, we're in a really quiet area of Georgia, and not a whole lot of, you know, people may disagree about stuff, but they keep it to a really polite level. And people who lie, cheat, and steal are really negatively regarded here.
So, yes.
the obviousness of the steal here in Georgia is causing a lot of offense. And the fact that Kemp and our Secretary of State seem to be just sort of, oh, well, that's the breaks, is just not going over well. There's a sense that this is just not how it's done, more than anything else.
Well, you know, the thing is, and I have tried to avoid anything except a few occasional comments about the election, because I just don't want to get bogged down in the details of it. You know, it's one thing as you're leading up to, you know, the thing and you do the polling, and then on election night, you count the votes. But all of this legal argle bargle, it's dismaying to me. And I'm watching people on our, you know, all of whom are allegedly on our side, divide up over the question of whether there is a chance for Trump to win the election. And so, you know, I'm going to wait and see. Those three words, wait and see, summarize my approach to what's going on right now.
I'm not able to make any reporting or firsthand, because it was one thing when I was the guy who was sitting in the courtroom covering a case or something like that. I'm not in the courtrooms in Georgia. I'm not in the courtrooms in Pennsylvania. The Third Circuit case basically has now been kicked up to the Supremes, and the state case that I'm going to mention in a little bit has Pennsylvania Supreme Court has ruled against the president, so that can go to the Supremes. We aren't far enough along in Georgia to know really what's going on at a federal level yet. The problem is, other than reading the complaints and seeing what the evidence is and reading through all the affidavits that are, you can get them online through Pacer, there are claims made there, there's sworn testimony, there's physical evidence, and so, it's a case to be tried. But other than to report on how the various courts have ruled, there's been all sorts of stuff all over places like Twitter and Gab and Parlay and MeWe and whatever, that's just wrong. You know, wish casting by both sides. And so it doesn't work for me. The one bright thing this week in terms of lawsuits, Carter Page has filed suit against the Department of Justice and several individuals, including James Comey, Andrew McCabe, Peter Strzok, Lisa Page, Kevin Kleinsmith, and a bunch of John Does, looking for $75 million in damages. And the suit is based on the civil damage claims that are possible under the FISA Act, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, the Federal Tort Claims Act, the Privacy Act, and it's a Supreme Court decision called the Bevin's decision. Discovery in that case is going to be marvelously interesting to me. And, you know, the best thing about that,
Hawaiian judge, John, you're assuming that a Hawaiian judge does not dismiss it out of hand.
I don't think it's filed in Hawaii, is it?
Hawaiian now, judge is one of these.
It's a joke.
I know. Yes. I believe it's what makes it dangerous is I believe it may have been filed in the District of Columbia, which means it will come up through the D.C. Circuit. But there are certain things that just aren't going to go away or be swept under the rug, regardless of who takes the oath of office in January. And I'm going to find that at least amusing.
Yes. Well, you know, something else that is not going to go away is the shift, and people have commented on it, is that the shift of the Republican Party. Hang on a second. Ginger's having a nervous breakdown. Ginger, you shut up. Oh, now Marlon's had it. We're having the dog barking contest. Do you hear Marley moaning there?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, this is real good.
Oh, it's so much fun to be in the real world, isn't it?
Yes, it's our soundproof studio.
Actually, I was just thinking what this kind of work used to be like, let's see, 50 some odd years ago when I was doing it on a room, an odd shaped room with, they didn't know so much about acoustical treatment back then. So with ceiling tiles on all the walls.
Right, right, right. That's what, yeah, those little asbestos probably. But anyways, okay. So what I was saying is that people have pointed out that whatever happens, okay, post-Trump, right, that the usual suspects of the establishment are forever, they're doomed. Okay, we're not going back to business as usual.
Yeah, well, I mean, you're even seeing things like the New Republic starting to catch on about you know, some of the problems that people are having, and there are all sorts of liberal press outlets now saying, well, you know, the Democrats really need to look at their problem here. One of their problems, and this is what's really interesting, is that not only did the Republicans flip, what, 13 House seats now?
Yeah, it is now, as of today, it's 13 House seats.
But they pulled majorities in most of the Rio Grande Valley. They won a bellwether county that's majority Hispanic.
Right.
Do you know why? Because the Hispanics along the border are concerned about immigration.
That's right. See, the immigration issue, okay, was always debated dishonestly. And I had a post this week called Immigration Fallacies and Logic. Oh, my goodness. Dogs, hey, what are the dogs barking at? Who or what are they barking at? My daughter-in-law. Hang on a second. Talk for a second, John.
Okay. Well, I'm not sure I can be as loud as the mic in the microphone as the dogs.
They're being impressively loud.
Diana, I'm going to let you cover for a second. And pull.
Okay. Well, I was going to talk a little bit. I loved Stacey's article about immigration, tracing the sheer dishonesty where they shifting the burden to, well, it's once again, why are you, prove you're not a racist, prove that unlimited immigration.
I'm sorry about that.
Diana's going.
Oh, go, Diana.
Briefly. I thought that that honestly, that is a very powerful thing. The fact that they have consistently, dishonestly shifted the burden of proof. It's not insane to question open borders. It's not, and we have to start talking honestly about, okay, what are the goals of immigration? Seriously. We're a nation of immigrants. Yes, very true. But you know, they used to exclude ancestors of your, well, at least of mine, fairly frequently. They didn't let some Irish in. In fact, quite a lot of Irish got turned back or sent elsewhere. So yeah, let's talk about immigration. Let's talk about how it actually works. Or
yeah, and
goals
and
for it.
Right.
You're
thank you.
Yours.
And the point that is one of the point, and I've got this post called Immigration Fallacies and Logic, and it was inspired by something that Spencer Morrison wrote 2 years ago. And I'm going to tell you, he wrote this at American Greatness. Criticizing Alex Narasta. Now, Narasta is the son of a conservative Christian Iranian immigrant who is talking, you know, his issue, his father is a documentary film producer, and he's very concerned about the persecution of Christians in Iran. And so, And so this is friendly fire then when Alex Narasta advocates for open borders. And so Spencer Morrison takes him to task and points out, as you said, Diana, that their most important rhetorical trick is to shift the burden, to make claims, in other words, to demand that defenders of the status quo or critics of open borders, right, should prove their own case rather than the advocates of the novel policy. In other words, it is not the status quo which must justify itself, since we've had immigration policy for decades.
And then we screwed it up in the 60s.
Right. Well, I'll get to that. The point is that protecting our own sovereignty, is not something new, right? This is not something novel. Rather, it's the advocates of policy change who must prove their own case, the benefits thereof, and to answer objections. And so this is a very point. And he points out, Spencer Morrison brings in the precautionary principle, right? That is, and I'm quoting him, deeply rooted in both our biology and empirical evidence. Biological evolution is largely governed by one question: approach or avoid. Approaching something novel may yield a lucrative new food source or reproductive partner, but it might also kill you. In fact, death, maiming, or disease is usually the more likely outcome. For this reason, human populations evolved a genetic predisposition for neophobia, risk aversion, while only a small minority of humanity carries a disposition toward novelty-seeking behavior. Okay, and so logic favors the status quo. What he refers to something called the Lindy effect, which implies that which survives is likely to continue surviving because of its proven utility. Meanwhile, most of what is new doesn't last very long. Time separates the weak from the strong. This explains why most new ideas don't last, while classics have sticking power.
As Granddaddy said, if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Right. And no one can deny, and I talked about this, and I will refer anyone who wants to understand what's wrong with our immigration policy to read Peter Brimelow's 1995 book, Alien Nation. Okay, Brimelow took a lot of heat over that, but he talks about the history of our policy, and people don't know this, okay, is that beginning in the 1920s, we initiated a policy of restriction and national quotas, okay, the idea being to maintain the
approximate ethnic balance that we had in the 20s. And that was disturbed by legislation run by Kennedy, Ted Kennedy. In the 60s. And rather than go back to what worked, they've been trying to Band-Aid stuff.
What they have done is that the failed policy, okay, within 10 years of the passage of the 1965 Immigration Act. Okay, it was apparent that there were problems, but rather than to repeal this law that didn't work, what they kept doing is passing a series of reforms, and there have been lawsuits that have also, you've had judicial decisions that have affected enforcement, and so the result is that we have a policy that is not actually a policy.
Yeah, look, there you can maybe say that some people thought maybe we should give this a shot to see how it works for a while. The thing is that at that point, they really didn't know what happens when you let Teddy Kennedy drive.
Right. Well, the thing is, the point is that as long as Ted Kennedy lived, okay, throughout, as long as he was in the Senate, there was no immigration legislation passed without his approval.
But as Diana alluded to earlier, and as you've been hitting around the point, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. Mm-hmm. I mean, for example, why would you think that someone who couldn't get anyone to show up at his rallies then pulled millions more votes in just the right cities than his predecessor? It doesn't make sense. That's not the kind of reasoning that you expect, right?
Right.
So it's, you know, it doesn't work.
Right. And
but that's the kind of thought process, wish casting, that leads people to think that socialism is going to work. We, on the other hand, are capitalists.
We are capitalists, ladies and gentlemen. We believe in the free market system and in service of the free market system as proud capitalists. It is now time when I tell you about the yellow button. Folks, if you will go to my blog, theothermccain.com, near the top of the center column, you will notice a yellow button with the word donate on there. If you will click on that button, it will take you to my PayPal account where you can contribute to the support of the blog to keep this free market enterprise going. And to help fund the blog and the podcast, and also to keep my lovely wife happy. Okay. This is supposed to be a job, not a hobby. And so by clicking the yellow donate button, you not only make me happy, you make my wife happy, and, you know, happy wife, happy life. Meanwhile, over at my good friend John Hogue's blog, Hogwash.com.
There is lurking in the sidebar a tip jar icon. Click on that and you will be taken off to my PayPal account where you can help support the blog as well. You can scroll down in the sidebar and there's an icon of a hat. That will take you to the Hogwash store, an excellent source of stocking stuffers and other trinkets branded in ways related to the blog. And of course, I get a cut of the action there. And in between the two, you'll find a link, and you'll also find it other places at Hogwash and at the other McCain and other blogs around the internet. Links to shopping on Amazon. And those of us who are members of the Amazon Affiliates Program actually earn a small commission on your qualified purchases that you make through the links on our blogs. We appreciate the support. But what you really need to remember, folks, beyond all else, is the five most important words in the English language.
Which are, hit the freaking tip jar.
Indeed. Thank you very much, Diana. Yeah,
it will help with the capitalism in this. And, you know, we're actually, at least I'm being in Maryland, am not located in the best capitalist spot in the universe, but it could be worse. I could be in Minnesota.
Yeah, what? Minneapolis, to be precise, an amazing column in the Minneapolis Star Tribune, which the local Republicans call the Red Star Tribune. But
this is a picture of what we can expect over the next 4 years if the Democrats win.
Yes, Kowalski's Market is a grocery store chain in the Minneapolis area. Their store at 2440 Hennepin Avenue serves the so-called Uptown neighborhood southeast of downtown Minneapolis. Unfortunately for local shoppers, A, Liberals in Minneapolis decided to defund the police department, and B, Uptown is in Representative Ilhan Omar's congressional district. A column in the local newspaper tells about a woman named Elaine who is brutally robbed in the parking lot of Kowalski's and quotes the store's security chief, Scott Nelson. Committed to pursuing justice for Elaine, Nelson laments that we, quote, need police service and we need more of it. South Minneapolis is worse than I've ever seen it, close quote. And he describes a surge of attacks, 20 a day or more, that are now striking people who are just going about their daily business like Elaine. Usually in a stolen car, perpetrators Nelson describes as, quote, young teens, 12 to 14 years old, close quote, cruise from lot to lot in neighborhood business districts waiting for a victim like a deer hunter in a tree, close quote.
It is opening day.
Right. When they are apprehended, Nelson says consequences are negligible. Quote, I arrest the same people over and over. Nothing happens to them, close quote. Now, I don't know what you know, and I've only been to Minneapolis that I can recall once in my life, but I'm going to take a wild guess that these marauding groups of teenage criminals probably aren't Trump supporters, if you know what I mean, and I think you do.
Mm.
Yes, well, anyways, the thing is that this is, I've said it before, one of the likely consequences of a Biden presidency would be a nationwide crime rate because Democrats are anti-police and pro-criminal. And what is happening in Minneapolis is an example of where such a policy leads. There have been last month, the Minneapolis Star Tribune reported that the city had experienced 76 carjackings or attempted carjackings in a span of 7 weeks. Okay. And in one of those carjackings, three teenagers, all of them minors, wrecked their stolen car during a high speed pursuit. They were all killed. And a kinsman of one of the dearly departed carjackers said, quote, my son, my nephew, the other little buddy, they were not bad kids. They just needed a little guidance, close quote.
And the question is, where did the guidance come from, or would it have come from in that community?
Well, I also quote
then.
Yes, I also quote
guidance. Where was he?
Yes, I quote the relative of the 72-year-old woman who was carjacked. They punched her in the face, knocked her to the ground to get her purse. They took off in her car, got halfway down the alley, realized they had the keys to her car, backed up, and she was standing up by now. They got back out, hopped in her car. Okay, and he says, and you know, people are trying to pretend like these carjackers are the victims, these teenage carjackers, they're the victims of social injustice or something.
But you know, your whole point about this is what we can look like, this is what things might look like under a Biden administration. And the thing is, what's really sad about Joe Biden is
if you everything
were, well no but if you remember back in the 90s, he was going to lock up all these black predators, and now he's not even going to have the cognitive dissonance to understand the irony of what's happening.
Well, yeah, you have to have cognitive function before you can have cognitive dissonance. And
but how does
Joe is obviously not playing with a full
but
deck.
how's this stuff playing, you know, in places like Valdosta?
Honestly, I can't watch. I don't really watch TV. It's a thing I avoid. I've seen some clips and I have heard some comments that amount to, oh my God, what is going on here? It's like Max Headroom, all the glitching. It's like it's shocking. And I hear, what are they thinking? This man can't be president. Well, my mom was here and we took her back today. My mom was here and mom is not as sharp as she used to be, but I'm here to tell you that I would be much more comfortable with the country in my mother's somewhat vague hands than in Joe Biden's. And I don't
Well,
think I'm alone.
you know, I'm by the way, Donald Trump won Lowndes County, and that's where
Yes,
our
he did.
beloved Diana is. He won Lowndes County by a 12-point margin. This is a very conservative part of America.
Yes, it is.
And
And full of so many yellow dog Democrats that won't vote for Democrats anymore that it absolutely astounds me.
Well, it's a couple of things to keep in mind, though. We do have Valdosta State University. We have the majority of our population is I think that our largest demographic group are people 24 and under. And this city is majority minority. It's
Well, the
the
city is, but the county,
county
the
is.
county, I'm looking at the demographics, and according to the 2010 census, the county is 58% white and 36% black. Now, by the way, do you realize that Minnesota is less than 6% black? Okay, it's 90, almost 95% white state. Okay, and yet they're having this crime wave up there, and they don't have this kind of crime down there in Valdosta, do they,
Oh,
Diana?
we have a drug problem. We have a this problem. We have a that problem. What we don't have is a defunded police department.
Well, and you know what you probably don't have compared to Minnesota is so many Lutherans. It's got to be the
It's
Lutherans.
the Lutherans. Yeah, the Lutheran menace. But actually, but the point is that is that it is in these lily white precincts that this liberalism just runs amok because they think, well, what can possibly go wrong? You see, whereas I think in Valdosta, the possibility of wrong is
A
a little bit
recognized
closer.
thing.
What?
A recognized thing.
Well,
Yes.
there is a picture of a sign over at Instapundit today, which he captioned with, where do I get one of these? And I'll bet you'll see it more often someplace like Valdosta than you would in Minneapolis or even Lake Wobegon. It says, virtue signaling has no home here.
Well, it's one of the thing is that you will find, okay, is that black people in the South are more conservative than most white people in the North. Okay. It is something about the experience that breeds conservatism,
Well,
you
that
know.
was what was the end of Mayor Pete in South Carolina,
Right.
even in among the Democrats. But that brings us to the
And
present.
keep in mind, by the way, Joe Biden was the conservative candidate in the Democratic primaries, and Clyburn came in for Biden in order to stop Bernie.
Yeah.
So.
But anyway, this all brings us to a post I did about conflicts of interest. The Presidential Transition Act was actually amended earlier this year in March, and it now requires, and I'm quoting, the eligible candidate will implement and enforce an ethics plan to guide the conduct of the transition beginning on the date on which the eligible candidate becomes president-elect, unquote. And one of the requirements of that plan is that it, quote, address how the covered eligible candidate will address his or her own conflicts of interest during a presidential term if the covered eligible candidate becomes president-elect. Okay, so I look forward to a clear statement from whoever becomes president-elect officially about how he or she is going to deal with foreign conflicts of interest.
Yes, and yes, that might be the Chinese candidate for president.
Whatever. Meanwhile, we've had kind of a flow to the show today. You folks may have noticed, but now things are actually going to get a little bit choppy because we're just going to cover some topics that I wanted to get done for the rest of the show. And I'm going to start off by reminding Stacy that he's a racist. I'm sorry, a racist.
Oh, okay. We're going there. Oh, we're yes. Okay. I'm sorry. I had actually clicked the wrong link in our agenda there. And was
well, then
looking.
Why don't you go to the right link?
Yeah. Okay. Well, my good friend, Professor Donald Douglas, has been a professor of history and political science at California's Long Beach City College for 20 years. And for the past decades, since mm-hmm. I've known him since about 2008 or 2009 online. Mm-hmm. And I think I met him at CPAC 2010. Well, actually, I met him in California for the 2010 Rose Bowl national championship game that Alabama played out in Pasadena because he lives out there in Long Beach. So I traveled out there. And that's where I met him and actually slept on his sofa for a while. So that's how well I know Donald Douglas. And he blogs at American Power Blog. And he is a person of color, according to the identity politics calculus, being a man of mixed ancestry. But what he really contributes at Long Beach City College is the kind of diversity that colleges really need, intellectual diversity. He may be the only Republican on the faculty, but whether or not he is, he is certainly the most outspoken, and he has blogged about his hassles with the college administration. And he's been invited to participate in a campus discussion about Ibram X. Kendi's book, How to Be an Anti-Racist. Okay. And Professor Douglas, his post on the subject carries the headline, How to Be an Anti-Racist. And I point out a little bit of irony here that Ibram X. Kendi, this radical author whose book is a bestseller and a sort of a how-to guide for the uber woke, he graduated from a high school in Manassas, Virginia called Stonewall Jackson High School. And he got his undergraduate degree at Florida A&M University, which is a historically black institution. And so that both of these schools have a sort of a Jim Crow heritage to them. And yet this irony, if he's ever addressed it, I don't know, but the point is that the institutions established by the regime of quote unquote white supremacy have been very good to Mr. Kendi, who, by the way, was born in New York City, right? Okay, but he didn't go to school in New York City. He came south to Virginia for his high school education and further south to Florida to attend Florida A&M for his university education. And so the South has done very good by him, but somehow we're all a bunch. And I wrote an American Spectator column last month entitled, "Are Americans Tired of Being Called Racist Yet?" Because I believe that these spurious accusations of racism tend to increase racial hostility rather than to reduce it.
Well, you know, there was a tweet just before we went on the air from Rita Paheni that was pointing to a Guardian post that says that Black Lives Matter movement, according to a survey in Britain, has increased racial tensions there, according to the 55% of the public.
Right, right. And all this discourse about white privilege, what you're doing is that you are reminding white people that they're white. Okay. And then, yes, well, okay, you're kind of pink there. But anyways, but in other words, what you're doing.
I'm almost phosphorescent white. As going back at least 11 generations, I can't find any ancestor that wasn't from Northern Europe or a descendant of someone from Northern Europe, you know, right? So, I mean, it's like, yeah, okay. All my ancestors that I can identify came from the British Isles or from Germany.
Yeah. And, you know, and here's the thing is that so far as I know, and I've traced my ancestry pretty far back on most of the lines. So far as I know, all of my ancestors were here before the American Revolution. Now, our friend Diana Dealey, judging by her last name, maybe there's some potato famine Irish ancestry there, eh?
Quite a lot. I think we're post-Civil War.
Yeah.
So far as I could discover, most of my ancestry is post-Civil War. Everybody got here after that. So, and yeah, factory workers, poor farmers up in Montana, a little bit of ranching out in East Texas. And then of course my grandfather was a bush pilot. I mean, this is the most exciting thing in my ancestry.
Let me ask, you said farming in what part of Texas?
No, Montana.
Up in East Texas, and also that was my grandfather's family, on my mother's side. And my grandmother grew up in Montana. I believe her father was a farmer. Grandma's been gone a long time. I can't ask.
All of my ancestors, except for one that I can determine for here before the revolution, I have one great grandmother who came from Germany in the 1870s and married a sodbuster in Oklahoma, which is where my grandmother McLaughlin was born.
Did she have high cheekbones? He asks.
Well, you know, I've never seen a picture of my great grandmother, but assuming that that's what my grandmother did, yes.
Well, you know, my kids.
But notice her surname, McLaughlin.
Oh, okay.
Okay,
right.
And again, the McLaughlins got here before the revolution.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you know, when people start bringing up this nation of immigrants thing, I point out that we did not have a nation, right, until we declared our independence. And won our independence from Britain. Okay, it wasn't a nation; it was a colony, and so
it was multiple colonies.
Yeah, right, right, right. And so the idea that the idea that we're all immigrants. Oh, wait! No, some of us were colonists. Okay, we created the nation. Our ancestors created the nation to which others immigrated.
Every signer of the Declaration of Independence was born as a British subject.
Right.
All of them except four were born in the colonies. Four of them were born in Ireland or Great Britain.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, you know, what is being argued here is a bait and switch about the meaning of the word immigrant. Okay. We're all of us. Well, not all of us, but most of us, our ancestors, if you go far enough back, right, came over from Europe.
Well, yeah, but if you go far enough back for some of the some Americans, but also other people around the world, they can trace their ancestry back to people who immigrated from Egypt. And before that, came from a family that came from the Persian Gulf
Mesopotamia
area. Speaking of Persians, though.
Oh, yes. We've had some news from that area of the world. Iran's top nuclear scientist is no longer with us. The Iranian state media reported on Friday morning that top nuclear scientist Mohsen, oh boy, I can't pronounce that, Fakhrizadeh, that's as close as I can get, Fakhrizadeh, was assassinated near the capital city of Tehran by unidentified, quote-unquote, terrorists after a fierce gun battle with his security team. Fakhrizadeh was described as the father of the Iranian bomb in a famous 2018 presentation by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
That was the presentation after they had stolen a whole warehouse full of Iranian classified documents.
Right. And it is widely speculated that Fakhrizadeh was a target of the Mossad. Folks,
Duh.
Yeah. Mossad is the
that's modern Hebrew for the Institute.
Right, it is the Israeli a spy organization, their intelligence organization, and they have a pretty ferocious reputation. Idi Amin, you may remember the rescue.
Actually, that was not Mossad. That was
IDF.
The IDF paratroopers.
Okay,
that was led by Netanyahu's older brother.
Yeah, right. You know,
a lot of people forget that Netanyahu was a special ops paratrooper along with his brother.
Yeah.
And there's a wonderful picture of him at age 23, and another picture of Obama at 23. One of them has a doobie and the other one has an Uzi.
Okay. Well, anyways, but I quote from Genesis chapter 3 here, and which God says to Abraham, quote, "I will bless them that bless thee and curse him that curseth thee." And that's the covenant with Israel, which has been binding for about 5,000 years, something like that.
And Hitler was unavailable for comment.
Right. You don't want to get on the wrong side of a verse like that. Trust me, folks, which is apparently what has happened to our Iraqi nuclear,
well, but just
Iranian nuclear scientists.
Yes, well, there was other science news, though, during the week.
Other science
news. Yes, the New York Post reported, I think it was yesterday, that a study of 18 men at the University of Birmingham in the UK found that drinking cocoa improved the participants' ability to quickly solve a series of complex mental tasks.
And this is illustrated with a famous meme from.
I decided I would pick illustrate that with the first thing that came to my mind, and it's a picture of the pajama boy, and next to him it says, "Wear pajamas, drink hot chocolate, talk about getting health insurance." Hashtag get talking. BarackObama.com/talk.
Yes, I'm trying. Yes, you can. By the way, if you go to Wikipedia and search for Pajama Boy, this tells the story of this December 2013 ad by Organizing for Action, which is the
predecessor to Organizing for America, which is Barack Obama's personal little
right. And Pajama Boy, they're actually the person shown there is actually an employee, was actually an employee of Organizing for Action, Ethan Krupp.
And you know what's so hokey about the picture? Look at him in the picture. Do you wear your wristwatch with your pajamas?
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it's just wrong.
Yeah. I'm going to update you here to tell you that he has now gone on to become a, he's doing digital marketing. I don't know. Oh my goodness. Well, anyways, yeah. but
it could be worse. He could have bought a bunch of hamburgers and corn dogs.
Ah, yes.
Crazy people are dangerous, Stacey.
Crazy people are dangerous, folks. And it's been about a week ago that this news broke in America. It involved... Hang on a second. It involved $57 worth of hamburgers and corn dogs. Okay, 4 quarter-pound hamburgers, 6 quarter-pound double burgers, 12 corn dogs, and a queso burger. That's what Roberto Carlos Silva, 23, allegedly ordered from the Sonic Drive-In in Bellevue, Nebraska, using an app in an identity theft case, okay? He was arrested and released from jail on a Thursday. He returned to Sonic on Saturday, that's a week ago, that would be Saturday the 21st, and shot 4 people. Bellevue police confirmed 2 people are dead after a shooting at Sonic Drive-In Saturday night. During a press conference Sunday evening, Bellevue Police Lieutenant Andy Jashinsky shed light on the events of the shooting and released the names of the 4 victims. Police also shared body camera footage of the moment the suspect, Roberto Silva Jr., was taken into custody. The deceased are Nathan Pastrana, 22, and Ryan Helbert, 28. The 2 other victims, aged 18 and 25, are still hospitalized for gunshot wounds. Silva was booked into the county jail early Sunday morning on 2 counts of first-degree murder and first-degree arson. Apparently, Silva was angry about getting caught using someone else's app. Okay, he was using someone else's identity.
Well, you know, if you steal my cell phone,
right,
I'm going to report it. And if you use the Chick-fil-A app tagged to my phone or one of the other apps to get your breakfast or your lunch or your dinner,
you're going to get caught.
I have a feeling that you will be met at, if you use the Chick-fil-A in my town, by the Westminster police. If you use the other Chick-fil-A that I commonly use, by the Carroll County Sheriff. Or if you use one of the other Chick-fil-A's, I'm sure that there'll be somebody looking for you.
But you're using a rational mind, okay? Roberto Silva obviously was not in his rational mind, he shot four employees of the Sonic Drive-In.
Yeah, because he didn't.
And set on fire a U-Haul truck full of fireworks.
Well, on the other hand,
he was angry.
Yes, but he wasn't getting what he wanted, and he's just another one of these spoiled, crazy people that we
Well, I've looked at a picture of him, and I'm thinking he don't need no more corn dogs, okay?
He's probably had his
fill. The man doesn't have a neck. But anyways, folks, you can hear that boogie-woogie piano in the background. That means we are coming toward the end of our podcast. We will be back next Saturday
at
our usual time, 7 o'clock Eastern.
Stacy, Diana, it's great talking with you again.
All right, rock and roll, folks. We are out of here.
Good night.
Mr. Breeze.